The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi everyone, just to let you know, we've got a very special guest on our show today. It is one of Britain's top nerds.
Oh, is it me?
It's even more top than you, James Harkin. You're not even supposed to be doing this bit.
Oh yeah, sorry.
No, you're very welcome. It is Bobby Seagull. He's not only a maths teacher, you might know him from University Challenge, where he came to prominence. He's a TV presenter. He's written a book called The Life-Changing Magic of Numbers, which will change your life. You should definitely get it. And he's also written the Monkman and Seagull quiz book. He's a brilliant guy, full of interesting nerdy facts. He now co-hosts the Maths Appeal podcast, but today he's on ours.
Yes, and I'm not on ours. So I'm not even sure why I'm here to be. Oh, I know why I'm here. I'm here to remind you that we are going on tour in the autumn and in the last day of summer, if this is how you count your seasons. Basically, the 31st of August, we're going to be in Inverness. Then we're going to be in Edinburgh, Aberdeen, Glasgow and Cardiff. If you're in any of those places, come and watch our show. It's going to be so much fun. Loads of facts, loads of silliness. We just can't wait to be back on tour again.
That's right. And even if you don't think that the 1st of September is the first day of autumn, which I don't happen to, if you disagree with James's delineation of the seasons, just come anyway. That's right. It's from the 31st of August to the 13th of September. Go to nosuchthingasafish.com/live. Get your tickets now. On with the show.
On with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Covent Garden. My name is Dan Schreiber. I'm sitting here with Anna Tashinsky, Andrew Hunter Murray, and our very special guest, it's Bobby Seagull. And once again, we have gathered around the microphone with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Bobby.
My fact this week is that the UK pop charts were originally compiled by phoning around 20 record shops and asking what their best-selling songs were that particular week.
So we're talking 50s, are we?
This was November 52?
Yeah, first November 52. Charts? So the Queen's Jubilee year, 52. So that means for the first few months of her reign, there was a different way of assessing the music charts, as it were. So in the US, they had the billboards. So for the billboards, it was a, I think since the 1940s, it was like weekly sales. But in the UK, they didn't have a chart based on music sales. So it was an organization called the PRS, the Performing Rights Society, and they would look at the best-selling sheet music. Mm. The word sheet always annoys me. in oh, school, sheet. If I say the word sheet, she's like, sir, is that what? Do you have two sheets on you, sir? I'm being very juvenile, sorry.
We've got the sense of humor of your students.
Bobby's a teacher, by the way, we should say.
So it was the sheet music. Yeah. So a man called Percy Dickens. Uh-huh. So hail Percy Dickens. Mm-hmm. So he was a magazine advertising salesman. And he was actually a founding member of the new Musical Express magazine, which is now NME. Although it's NME shut nowadays.
It's still online. It still functions online.
So RIP print copy. But
yeah.
Hail to the
it lives on.
Hail to the digital copies. So he thought, actually, what's the best way of getting advertising revenue for a magazine? And he said, actually, we can attract commercial advertising revenue if we tie up something with the record industry. So then he thought, oh, actually, how about we do some sort of record-based music chart? And that's how the initial brainwave spark for this
Okay,
came
so records were sort of like an obscure, you know, why are you buying a record? You could just buy the sheet music and your own
piano. Good thing you love yourself, yeah.
Okay, and then they decided calling around 20 shops would be the most reliable way to do that.
Yes, so but what his system was like that, but so what the management of NME decided was I think they agreed with 50-ish shops that they would be willing to exchange data. Mm. So, but with those 50-ish shops, I think it's 53, but it's 50-ish, it's always safer. Mm. As a mathematician, you know, you don't like giving exact numbers. So every Monday morning, Percy Dickens would pick up the dog and bone phone and call up about 15 to 25 shops, on average 20 shops, and each store would give their top 10. But this is where things get a bit murky, because he would then have a points-based system they'd allocate to this. And this is a bit, we don't know, it's like a Eurovision-type system. We don't know the exact system. But because of that, it meant that his first ever top, I think he was trying to do like a top 12, but there were 15 entries, because three entries, number 7, 8, and 11, tied. And we all know in reality it's unlikely that three songs would have exactly the same number of sales.
What were the chances?
But because he went to 20 shops.
Yeah.
You're going to probably have like two songs with 17 sales each. Yeah.
And then how are they, because I sort of read that they're not that great at monitoring anyway, are they, the shops? And also, they might just say the song that they like best.
Well, if they were told, we're going to be ringing you up and asking for your sales, they probably would keep the sales.
Yeah.
Maybe they'd count.
But I like that. I do find myself wondering if anyone ever tried to game the system by picking a particular shop and saying, well, I'm going to send 15 different friends in here all to buy this one single hope they get phoned up this week by Percy Dickens.
That did used to happen, though. I don't know if specifically to British charts, but certainly overseas in America, you would have, you know, the really rich people just buying huge units of an album from one specific store just to get those numbers up, to get them into the charts.
That was
a thing to get in the charts. I mean, that's happened forever. Taylor Swift's doing a gig and she's bundled it with the new album, or she's released a new t-shirt and she bundles it with the album, and so you cheat the sale because
does it count as a sale?
It used to, and not anymore. Because they noticed that bands were just, you know, cheating the system. They were gaming the system. And
so are they actually not popular at all? Ed Sheeran, Taylor Swift. Does it turn out?
No one likes it. All my Spotify top 10 is all false.
Exactly. Well, no, but May 2020, Dua Lipa, she had Future Nostalgia, which was the lowest selling number one album ever. Imagine getting to number one and finding out you were the worst at it.
That's an awkward record to have. Why did they tell her that? That's mean.
Yeah, 7,317 copies.
Wow.
That was the sixth week that she was at number one.
Oh, okay.
There's
got to be some tailing off. Yeah.
But
was still number one in that week.
Yes, it was still number one in that week. And so what's amazing about this is that it's basically since streaming music has come along that the charts have been altered in such a weird way. So 1,000 album streams equates to one record sale, is what they say. One physical product.
Yeah, I think that's how in the UK, isn't it?
Yeah, that's in the UK. That's how you do that. But also what they found is so interesting, such an interesting time, where gigantic musicians who are global names are fighting it in the charts with bands that are independent local British ones with a big fan base who can get them to that number. So they're in the charts, but because everyone's streaming the biggies, they're not buying the album. But then the little ones, they've got such hardcore fans who might buy 5 or 6 copies to give to their friends and family. They're making a dent in the charts.
Oh, I see. So you mean the bands that only their friends and family are buying it, they buy physical albums, but because that's so rare to do,
and they count, and I think they count more in the equation as well. So I think for singles charts, like 100 paid streams is one sale, and 600 free streams, so the freemium versions, is one sale.
Yeah,
so if you pay for your Spotify, iTunes, and you're streaming it, it's 6 times more valuable than someone on a ad-based.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, that's good, because if I find a song I like, I will often listen to it 600 times.
If you buy it once, it's the same.
Oh.
You don't have to subject yourself to the 600 listens, and you can just buy it and then never listen again.
I want to, A, save the money, and B, I do really like the songs I like, so I do it. Just back to Percy Dickens and the first listen, 52.
Yep.
I was reading about the first ever number one single, which was called Here in My Heart, and it was by Al Martino. Do you guys read about him?
No.
He was crazy. So I'd never heard of Al Martino before. He was an Italian-American singer and former bricklayer, and he went on to great fame because he was in The Godfather playing a singer called Johnny Fontaine.
Oh, yeah.
And Johnny Fontaine is the one who leads to someone getting a horse's head in the bed.
Yes, yes. That's right.
Confession, I've not watched The Godfather.
Well,
I was told off at a party recently about this. I do know the fact, but I was not. I've not seen The Godfather.
Well, it's a very
worth watching.
Exciting...
It's only average.
Yeah,
it's no grown-ups with Adam Sandler.
But then, this is the really weird thing about Al Martino. So he played a singer connected to the mafia in the film The Godfather.
Yeah.
But then eventually he was forced to leave the UK by the mafia, because they tried to buy him out of his American management contract, and there was some controversy and there was some disagreement. And then so...
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So was he involved in mafia-ish circles, it sounds like, a bit?
It sounds like you may have met them sometimes.
I don't know.
I don't know. Oh my God.
Method acting.
Good. Oh my God.
I went to method.
I'm Percy Dickens.
Yeah.
So do you know his second claim to fame? So obviously the charts is his first claim to fame. But his second one is, so do you know we have modern sort of like award ceremonies and stadium rock concerts? So he actually, in the early 60s, he pioneered something called the Enemy Poll Winners Concert. And he managed to get, I think, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And again, this is like a tenuous claim to fame, but some people in the music industry say that was responsible for the sort of award ceremonies we have nowadays. So he was the first person in the UK to say, oh, let's have a big, all the winners of the awards, music awards, let's get them all together in a big concert at Wembley. So I think it was Wembley Arena, which is the Empire Pool at the time. So that's his second.
It's his fault. Right. We have these awards ceremonies.
Yeah, I love that. Wow. What a big character.
So he's from my, I didn't realise he's from my hometown of East Ham. So I'm from East Ham, from the London Borough of Newham, which is why I'm a massive West Ham fan. But I never knew he was from East Ham, and I was trying to find out where in East Ham, and I can't, but if there's people, listeners out there, we need to get a blue plaque for this man in East Ham, because he founded the chart and possibly pioneered the music award ceremony.
Yeah, that's incredible. I agree. Love that. I was reading about, did you guys happen to read about the first ever top 100 Billboard single? No. So this was in 1958, and it was a song that was called Poor Little Fool by Ricky Nelson. And yeah, so it came out, it was a massive hit, and it was actually written by a woman called Sharon Sheely. And she wrote the song because she'd met Elvis Presley when she was 15, and he basically encouraged her to get into writing. So she thought, okay, I'll do that. She based it, the song, on a very short fling that she had with a guy called Don Everly of the Everly Brothers.
Ooh,
So the song that's the first number one is actually based on a musician, which is quite cool in its own right. And effectively, she might have dabbled with some other songs, but from what I read, this was the first song that she wrote. And so she thought, I need to get someone to record it. So she thought Ricky Nelson could be perfect for this. So she drove to his house and she faked breaking down outside of it, the car, not emotionally. So she broke down, her car supposedly was broken down, and she was like, please, can you help me? And he was like, yeah, okay. And he came out and he tried to help her with the car. And then she went, I've got a song, you got to hear it, I want you to sing it. And he heard it and he went, okay, I'll do it. And that's the first number one, her first song at 18, handing it by faking a breakdown. Yeah.
Did he fix her car that wasn't broken? What happened there?
It fooled him because he didn't know he could do that. He subsequently left the music industry and became a mechanic.
Because, the worst mechanic. There is someone who collected every single track that entered the top 40 from 1952 onwards. A guy called Keith Sivier. And he died in 2015, so the collecting stopped then.
Oh.
But he bought every single track, every one that entered the top 40.
Wow. How many is that? Do you know?
Well, his lounge alone contained 35,000 vinyls. He had and 10,000 CD singles as well. I mean, it was a lot.
We think that's cool, but for his kids, every time they went home, you'd have that conversation with your dad. Like, Dad, have you thought about clearing these out?
He lived in a normal house in Twickenham. It was not a big place, but it was entirely full of stacked records. Just insane.
Wow.
But if I was his kids or children or nephews and nieces, I'd feel like a responsibility to continue that from 2015. You can't just like from 52 to 2015, you can't just leave it like, family tradition.
Exactly.
I don't think I read a piece about it, and I don't think anyone in his family was saying, oh,
maybe
we'll keep going.
I know. Yeah. You could be the foster child.
Yeah.
Can I just tell you something fun about sheet music charts?
Yeah.
What type of music?
Sheet music.
How many sheets?
This music is sheet. So Bobby, you mentioned earlier about sheet music being how the charts were compiled before the 50s. And that was how people took in music. Basically, they went and bought sheet music and then I guess they'd have to play it at home or look at it and imagine it being played. And so sheet music publishing and promotion was a huge industry. And you got people who were hired as song pluggers who would be like demonstrators who would sit in shops that were selling sheet music and they'd have to play the music. So
Lovely.
Someone would say,
cool.
I want to buy this by so-and-so. And then certain people got their starts in life doing that. Lil Hardin, who was Louis Armstrong's wife, started as a song plugger. Irving Berlin, George Gershwin started as song pluggers.
Did they slip their own songs in? Is that how they got big?
Well,
this is a cracking hit.
Yeah.
people come up to you in the shop, mm-hmm. and do they say, I want to buy a song that goes like this, ba-da-ba-da-ba, and then they play it? No.
They could do that. I guess you'd adapt to your customer. So if you came in and, you know, sang the,
that,
I don't know,
that.
Yeah.
They'd say, oh, well, you might like this song.
I think, yeah, exactly, like a Spotify algorithm.
Well, no, they're more just, they're radio. They're just they're a live radio. They're just playing the hits, presumably, from the week.
Oh, and people say, oh, I like that
yeah,
one.
What's that song you're playing? Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're like a jukebox.
Like a Shazam-y type of.
Yes. Yeah. The original Shazam. Yeah. Yes.
But it wasn't just playing. They'd also be paid by the song publishers to do things like they go into theatres and in the intervals they'd be paid to start singing a tune really loudly, wow. And you'd have to get the whole audience to sing along with you.
Cool.
Which you have to be quite confident to do that because you risk looking like a psychopath. But yeah, and then people are like, God, I heard that tune at the theatre in the interval recently. I'm going to buy it.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
What a clever way. I mean, we should do that. We should go in the intervals at theatre and go, my fact this week is that...
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that there are two members of the National Trust's food and beverage team who both have the surname Kit Kat. Kit Kat. So I got to tell you how I got this fact. I was at an event recently and someone came up. It was a podcast event and someone came up saying, hey, I really like your podcast. I said, oh, thanks. And we had a bit of a chat. Turned out he worked for the National Trust, and then I went off. And then about an hour later...
Then you went off. So he said, I work for the National Trust, and you just turned around and walked away.
Yeah, I actually slapped him before I went as well. Yeah. And then, so I had to go to an event and then I finished. And as I came out, he clocked me from across the room and he kind of ran towards me and said, I forgot to tell you my favorite fact. And this was the fact. So his name is Jack Glover. He's a podcast producer for the National Trust. They have their own podcast. Yeah. And yeah, and he was saying that basically he doesn't know either of these Kit Kats, but someone mentioned that there was a Kit Kat who worked for the National Trust. And as they were Googling it, they found another Kit Kat.
So they're related.
They're not related because they're spelt differently. Yeah. So Louisa Kit Kat, who spells it KITCAT, and then you've got Sam Kit Kat, who's just got one T. We don't know if they know each other. I've tried to find them online. They're on LinkedIn. I didn't have time to get through to them. I think Louise is on Instagram, but it's a private account, so I couldn't get through to her.
Gosh, these poor Kit Kats. Yeah, some weirdo trying to contact them all week.
I've just never heard the surname Kit Kat before.
No, me neither. I've never heard of that. That's a brilliant fact. It's amazing. Food and beverage. Love it.
Should we say what... I don't know if overseas every country has its own national trust in the same kind of way, but in Britain, there's basically an organization. They're an independent charity and they buy up places of national importance and they make it public. So they make places that might otherwise have been private, like Winston Churchill's old house, Chartwell, that was bought by them and it was transformed into a public place. And so it means that the public can go and visit all of these extraordinary places.
The National Trust has some amazingly weird stuff.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So I was just reading about like the odd things they have. Did you know they've got the National Rhubarb Collection?
Ooh. Cool.
Is that just lots of people muttering away in the background?
out of rhubarb. Yeah. They've got the largest fern in the UK at Colby Woodland Garden. It's 400 years old, 19 feet around.
Wow.
Impressive.
Big fern.
Wow. Big fern.
Ooh. Big fern. And they've got one nudist beach, which I've been to, actually.
Have you?
Oh. Yeah.
Studland. I may have mentioned that before. It's in Dorset.
Studland.
I went down there with my friends and we didn't know it was a nudist beach.
Did you get naked?
Yeah.
No, we didn't. I didn't. I don't know if they did, but no, we didn't.
But
we didn't.
Happened to be naked at the time.
Fortunately, I was able to seamlessly blend in. No, it was because it's quite sand duney, so it's quite the landscape is quite undulating, so it's not immediately apparent that it's a nudist beach. But every so often, someone will just hove into view who is naked, and you sort of pop up like a little meerkat, and you think, oh, that's funny, and then pop back down. Anyway,
Do you think the undulations are a nod to the human form?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Well, because this actually does link to another National Trust property.
Oh, really?
West Wickham Park, West Wickham Park Gardens were designed in the shape of a woman's anatomy.
Oh.
Apparently.
Which anatomy? Like the whole thing?
I think the whole thing. There's,
the nose, eye,
it's just the ear, the left earlobe. No, it's mostly centred on a mound of Venus, which has a passageway underneath it.
Oh, blimey.
So I think that's a vagina. This is so cool. This was the home of Sir Francis Dashwood, who founded something called the Hellfire Club.
Oh, yeah. Ooh.
Which is it's an awful club. It's basically a worse version of the Bullingdon Club, but also really fun. Which
is
basically
around the Hellfire Club or?
Maybe it is. It's a club for posh people to meet up and do really sordid stuff, so it probably is still around. he designed this house and gardens and then this hillside nearby, which you can also visit, which is National Trust. And it's full of tunnels and caves that were covered in like phalluses and priapic statues. And they'd like act out religious rituals there, but in a porny way. And so they'd have nuns, but they'd be sex workers, and they'd be asked to lie down, and then the members of the club would lick holy wine from their navels and stuff like that. But lots of people got involved in it. Ben Franklin paid a visit.
Ben Franklin.
Did a bit of navel licking, I'm afraid.
Ben?
Wow, the Ben, first name terms.
My mate Ben.
Not even first
my
name ben. Terms, abbreviated first
abbreviated,
name
that's
terms.
What got me.
Benny F.
Benny F. Yeah, well, in the club, we refer to each other.
Oh, sure,
names. Anyway, after he died, Francis Dashwood, then his heirs called in Capability Brown, the famous garden designer, to remove quite a lot of the more sordid elements of the garden.
Wow.
Right. You can still visit.
Do you know what the membership, anyone know the membership price for National Trust for a single person?
Oh, I don't.
I have been a member, so...
But actually, you know, Benjamin, how much is that in the States? Benjamin, is that a $100 bill?
I think it is. Yes, it is. We call it a Ben, but
a
yeah.
Ben. So actually, I think maybe based on it might actually be the price of a Ben. I think it's about £76.80, which might be a Ben.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
close. Yeah.
That's a Franklin.
Yeah.
Does that get you into all of them for
free?
£76.80?
Yes, £76.80 for 1 year.
That has gone up a lot.
Inflation.
Yeah, I guess you had
the cost of living crisis. Hello.
Yeah. People can't even afford to visit stately homes anymore.
I've had to buy cheap wine to lick out of the sex worker's navel.
So I was looking at the National Trust website, and they very proudly declare, we have 5.37 million members, which is more than Costa Rica. Are they proudly like an invasion? Like, we shall arm, get your shovels and picks and your membership cards. We shall go to Costa Rica.
So funny.
They're quite proud of
it. It is. I mean, that is huge. That is really huge.
That's in their website. But I didn't see further digging. Actually, it's apparently 5.9 million rather than 5.37. So their website's out of date. So in theory, they could be more ambitious. Forget Costa Rica, Denmark or Singapore. They could invade them. National Trust.
Which would you go for? Denmark, I think, probably has more historic features that they
easier
could
to get to from Britain as well. You can get like the Vikings.
Yeah,
take back.
Yeah, Denmark. Let's stick with Denmark. I love. There's one place that Jack was telling me about, who sent me this fact, called Orford Ness, and it's a nature reserve, and they have lots of amazing animals there. They have the white-faced woodland sheep, but they've also got a nuclear bomb.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
really? Is that why the sheep look so pale?
It's still there. So basically, Britain detonated an atomic bomb, didn't they, in the 50s, 1952.
Yeah, there were a few tests and things like
that. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. We had some tests, and the pre-test was done at this place, Orford Ness. Mm. And the reason that it was done there is what they did was they built these big kind of buildings that would go into the ground, and the bombs were effectively being tested for their stress levels. So what they did was they put them in the buildings and then they just shake them and just kept shaking them. And just shake. And the idea was, if you were transporting a nuclear bomb by plane, they wanted to make sure that it didn't detonate as it was being flown to the place, purely because of the stress levels that it would have. So this is where they did it, and they still have one of the bombs sitting there. It's deactivated.
Okay, obviously. I was going to say,
they always use deactivate. I mean, they didn't test it with an armed bomb anyway, but it's sitting there next to the sheep.
I'm going to Orford Ness in a couple of weeks.
Get out.
Yeah.
Go see
the bomb.
I will. That's so cool.
The founding story of the National Trust is, it's got a lot of great characters at its beginning, hasn't it? So there were sort of three founders. It was a lawyer, a clergyman, and a social reformer.
Sounds like
Octavian.
A sort of joke, doesn't it? A lawyer, a priest, and a social reformer walked into...
What happens? They make a socially responsible organisation. this woman called Octavia Hill, who was the eighth daughter of her father, which seriously, I always like. If you're called Octavia or Tertius or whatever, be the eighth.
Yes.
And so maybe that's why he had eight daughters, so he could call one Octavia. And she was amazing. She, her parents had sort of set up a school for the poor and stuff and were do-gooders anyway. So she had good examples set for her. But then her dad went bankrupt and left the family in the 19th century.
Maybe because he had eight children.
Yeah. It does.
I've read a story when age 14, she was left home alone. Her family had gone to church.
I know this story, isn't it? And two burglars...
The iron on the face.
Yes. She mutilated them horribly.
Yes.
But they came back. They came back.
Now you've said that, I think this might have been the Home Alone origin story.
Yeah.
Because it was one burglar.
Seriously?
Yeah. One burglar came in, fell out of a cupboard, actually. She was on the third floor of their house. He fell out of a cupboard where he'd been hiding. And apparently she said, "How did you get in here?" And he said, "I walked up the stairs." And she just said, "Then will you please to walk down them again?"
Ooh.
And then she led him down the stairs and out of the house.
Wow.
Yes. So that's much shorter.
Did need a punch up, didn't it, for the Macaulay Culkin version?
But what a compliant burglar. Like, how responsible.
Yeah.
Say ethical burgling.
Ethical burgling. Yeah. Like, if you ask me nicely, I won't do it.
Yeah.
And didn't she... I think I'm right in saying that she later went to New York and she got lost, didn't she?
Yeah. She boarded the wrong plane.
Yeah.
That's right. Octavia Hill, amazing. I kind of got sidetracked reading about the clergyman of the three founders, Hardwick, Drummond, Rawnsley. Which is such an incredible...
Formidable name.
Yeah, it is formidable. So he was a bishop from Lincolnshire. He was described as the most active volcano in Europe by one of his parishioners because he was so energetic, involved, always, you know, coming up with new schemes and committees and plans and projects and papers and all of this, you know, constantly writing and thinking and meeting. But his main interest, as far as I can tell, seems to be building bonfires. Like, he had this huge passion about bonfires. So there was a diamond jubilee for Queen Victoria in 1897, I guess it would have been.
Right.
And he was the head of something called the National Bonfire Committee. He basically spent his whole time suggesting huge bonfires at any opportunity, any national opportunity. So when the First World War ended, 1919, they had huge bonfires everywhere. Mm-hmm. Coronation in 1911, huge bonfires.
Sounds like, how many National Trust properties did he burn down in the course of trying to found
it? It's just amazing. Like, there are these huge towers of work. Like, the coronation ones in 1911 are so impressively massive. And he organised 2,200 of them across the entire country.
Oh, wow.
Like, it was a mega theme of his life.
Really?
Yeah.
We should have like a bonfire czar, national bonfire czar.
Oh, that's such a good idea.
That's an awesome idea.
Because we just had the Jubilee and there were lots of beacons. But they were tiny compared with these things. I mean,
I don't know. We're making cuts to the civil service. I'm not sure we've got where the bonfires are in Boris's vision.
Just back to Octavia for one second, because I think it's worth mentioning. There's quite a lot of descriptions about her character and who she was by her friends, and I find them such like bizarre representations. So she had a friend called Henrietta Barnett, and Henrietta described her saying she was small in stature with a long body and short legs. She did not dress. She only wore clothes, which were often unnecessarily unbecoming. Her mouth was large and mobile, but not improved by laughter. Cutting stuff.
And one of her friends writing this.
It was her friend. Gertrude Bell had a comment about her saying she was despotic. So not a great review. And the Bishop of London, who was called Frederick Temple, he had a meeting with her. And afterwards he wrote, she spoke for half an hour. I never had such a beating in my life.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, it sounds like she was really, you know, sort of confident.
She was formidable, definitely. Yeah. But then I was reading a lot of...
Just quick nominative determinism. Sorry, bishop called Frederick Temple.
Yes.
That's nice.
Good pause. Good pause for that.
Octavia Hill as well. Hill, National Trust.
Yeah.
Because the first thing that was donated to the National Trust was a hillside.
Really?
Yeah. By someone called Fanny Talbot.
You know that one of the lawyer that was one of the trio was Robert Hunter.
Oh, yeah.
He's a lawyer. Lawyers are like hunters. They're like, find it.
You stretch it too far, Bobby. Yeah. I'm sorry.
That's one, two. It's okay. You're new to the show. It's fine. You know, you'll find your feet.
You've lost everyone.
Beatrix Potter, too. I'm sure you guys came across this.
Yeah.
What did you just say?
Beatrix Potter.
Well, what's her...
I'm sure you guys came across...
Beatrix.
Are you pronouncing her name in a really odd way?
Beatrix
Potter. Oh, God, I've said it all my life. Is it Beatrix Potter?
I say Beatrix Potter.
Beatrix.
Yes, Beatrix.
What did you say?
Beatrix.
Oh, like beetroot.
Yeah, yeah, I guess.
People are going to have an absolute field day with that.
Yeah, well, get over it, guys. I say Beatrix.
Sorry, go on.
Christ. She donated so much to the National Trust. She donated 4,000 acres. After the success of Jemima Puddle Duck and Mr. Jeremy Fisher and all of that, she just devoted her time to breeding sheep.
Sorry, Puddle Duck?
You, oh, God, how are you meant to pronounce
it? Well, it's just another...
Jemima,
you know,
Puddle Duck, yeah?
Do you not know Jemima Puddle Duck?
No. Right. Oh, that's a character. That's a character within the...
19th century reformer. Prison reforms, particularly.
Founder of the National Trust, I thought we were saying.
She advocated, I think, for free bread for everybody. Yes. Puddle Duck. Yeah.
Near like watering holes. Yeah.
Oh, come on, who gives a duck a surname? That's unfair.
Oh, my God.
Okay, it is time for fact number three, and that is Andy.
My fact is that the French-speaking clock was created by an astronomer who was annoyed that members of the public kept phoning his office to ask for the time. Which would be annoying.
It would be.
So this is from an article in The Times, which was about the fact that the French-speaking clock, l'horloge parlante, is winding down. And winding up. And closing down. And it's clock-related things. Yeah. It's the oldest speaking clock in the world, I think, or it was the first one founded, really? And it was pioneered by a man called Ernest Esclangon in 1933, who was a French astronomer, and I think was at the sort of official, you know, the government.
He was the director of the Paris Observatory. Yeah.
Ah, there we go. Okay, yeah, and people kept ringing up to ask the time because that was one of the ways before speaking clocks existed. You verified the absolute nailed on time. Was you phoned an astronomer, and his phone line was constantly busy with people phoning up. And his office staff were always being distracted by people saying, "Yeah, it's 10:33 and a bit." Yeah. Yeah. And so that was the inspiration.
I love the idea that maybe he spotted an oncoming comet, you know, crashing into Earth, and he just wasn't able to notify anyone.
Did he have then a reliable clock sort of in front of him that he set, or would he? How was he telling the time?
I don't know. I think it would have been. That's where the official timekeeping device for the country was kept.
That's where it started.
I think the Paris Observatory was where it was.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, the way that Greenwich were the official stewards of, you know, official time.
Because there was huge rivalry time-wise between Britain and France. It's the main beef between us almost to this day. I would say it wasn't there. It was like, where's official time going to rest? And it ended up being Greenwich for the world. But I think Paris Observatory was the other big contender.
I think they defined Greenwich time as Paris time minus 2.5 minutes or whatever number of minutes was. And they did it so until about the 1990s. Like they really dug their heels in on Greenwich time. Yeah.
So this clock, the first speaking clock in France, it was the 14th of February, 1933, when it debuted. And on its very first day.
Oh,
romantic.
That's true. Yeah. That's lovely. So 140,000 people called up, or rather recalled up, trying to hear it because they could only get 20,000 answers during the course of the day because they had 20 lines that were doing it. So that might have been one person just recalling, just desperate to hear it. But
incredible.
Very, very lonely people on Valentine's Day that year.
When you were children, did you ever call up the 123 number? In the UK, we've got like a 123 number.
Yeah, I did.
I used to annoy my parents. I used to call them up, or the number, and you'd hear like, at the third stroke, the time would be, and then 10 seconds later, I'd call again, and then my parents get like an enormous bill. Like,
it was so expensive. Yes. So expensive.
But in the UK, I think is the BT speaking clock. And at some stage, they called it timeline, or they call it TIM for short, because if you, for the major cities, if you're trying to get the time, you dial 846, which TIM would be on that.
Oh, so good.
Although ironically, even though the name was TIM, the first two clock speakers in Britain for the first 50 years were females, Ethel Jane Kane and Miss Pat Simmons. But the first one, there was an incredible competition to select them. So there was a pool of 15,000 telephone operators who worked for the General Post Office, and they organized a nationwide competition to find the golden voice. And a bit like X Factor or Britain's Got Talent, they got like the judges. We got the poet laureate John Masefield. Yay! We got the actress Dame Sybil Thorndike. Yay! And we got the chief BBC announcer Stuart Hibbert. Yay! For this week's edition of The Speaking Clock. Who'll win this week?
So, awesome.
Proper competition.
It was so eminent, the panel.
Yeah.
Poet laureate.
Well,
and Sybil Thorndike, who's a famous name even
who's
today.
Who's that? I actually don't
just
know
Sybil.
Just
an incredibly famous actress from the time. Of, you know, great heroine of stage, basically.
Right.
I think she was a bit pre-screen almost. Yeah.
But then you've got the crap one on the end. Is there one of those in X Factor, the one who's like the expert, but no one cares about them?
Someone called Mrs. Atkinson and Lord Eiley were rounded out the committee in 1936. But they always have a kind of fancy panel of judges, which I love. So I think we're only on the fifth voice of the speaking clock now, the official speaking clock. Mm. They always have a fancy panel who choose. And I think the panel these days always includes the previous speaking clock voice. If you see what I mean.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
They sign up to... So it was a guy called Brian Cobby who was on the committee in 2006 when they were picking the new voice, but he had been the voice for the previous 20 years.
Wow.
So they had him, the current voice, Natasha Kaplinski.
Oh,
newsreader.
And Strictly
really nice
Come Dancing.
Yeah, did she win the first... Or was she in the first season?
She was in the first season,
great point.
Certainly.
I don't know if she... This was pre or post her Strictly triumph.
So she knows how to read stuff.
Exactly.
I guess she knows what a good voice sounds like.
I know. And the other voices... The other members of the panel included the guy who voiced the National Lottery.
Oh.
Okay.
47.
Who can read numbers. Exactly, reading numbers. It's basically, that's the gig.
My dream job.
Who can read... Who can read numbers best? You're going to get the lottery guy. And then a couple of others. But it wasn't the poet laureate.
Mentioned Brian Cobby because I found unsubstantiated claims that at one stage he may have been the person that did the voiceover to the Thunderbirds 5.
I read that.
But, but I think the Thunderbirds... The main creator says it wasn't him, but Brian Cobby claims it was him.
Ooh. Interesting.
Wow. Okay, controversy.
What's happened there?
Yeah.
It's quite a strange thing to claim if it wasn't you, isn't it?
Like, well, you might think it, like, you know, Brian Blessed claims that he was the voice of Tarzan's when Johnny Weissmuller couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, okay.
But is that true? I don't know.
Is it a Brian thing? Brian's just make up random shit about themselves.
When Cobby recorded his script, so he started in 1985. I really like this. So you don't have to do 24 hours, obviously. You just... there's a limited number of numbers that you have to record. And there are something like 86 different prompts. But you have to record, you know, for about an hour, I think.
Oh, okay.
But the script that Cobby recorded was about 33 pages with various different things on it, you know, that you have to... But amazingly, they spent a while in this recording studio. They sent him home and then they had to summon him back because they forgot to record the O'clock. You only need that once.
Okay.
But it is important.
It's
important, yeah.
You need it for the beats because when it's on the hour, because usually it'll be, you know, it's 1:24 minutes. But
say precisely at that? When it's like a round time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
They do. Yeah, yeah.
2 o'clock, precisely.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh. Precisely. That's what everyone loved about the first reader was her precisely.
Oh, really?
Oh, really?
Yeah, the famous word. Her most precisely. Famous word.
Can I ask, did they like it because it sounded quite sexy? Is that what you were trying to...
Get your brain out of the gutter.
Just curious. Like, you know, sometimes people with sexy accents, you know... Can make any word sound sexy.
I'm sure there were people on Valentine's Day who did ring up, cock in hand.
I do like the use of the word
that came from.
I do like the use of the word sexy for time because time is based on base 60.
Oh.
And sexagesimal is the...
Oh, that's so
that is very sexy. You need a sexy voice.
Sexy time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the joke you were making, wasn't it?
Exactly. I knew that we had a mathematician in. I thought, I'm just going to leave that.
She, Ethel Cain, she had a speech impediment, which they didn't notice when they were recording it. She had a slight speech impediment. She whistled a bit at the end of each word.
It's 2 o'clock.
and that's where the cuckoo clock comes from.
Yeah, but they didn't notice in the recording, so it must have been quite slight. And then they decided, because the clock ran on these beautiful glass discs.
Mm.
I have read about it. I don't understand fully the mechanism they used, but they had to take the glass discs out of the machine and edit them, and it took about a year to fix this.
Oh, to get rid of the whistle.
Very minor thing.
No way.
Yeah, way.
She can say the word precisely. Is that the word? Precisely?
Precisely, yeah. Down at the other
sexy
end of the line.
So in the 1970s, I think 1971, the UK experienced decimalisation, so we lost the imperial system. We had imperial with the decimals as well. Mm-hmm. But in 1975...
Not for much longer, though.
Thank God. Yeah, yeah. Oh, I missed my ounces and my miles and...
farthings.
Farthings. Hogs penny heads. Farthings. So in 1975, in a Northern Ireland BBC programme called Scene Around Six, they had a newscast and it started off saying, it looks a lot more frightening than it actually is, but the government's preparing people for the phased introduction of the decimalisation of time. You'll need to get dual standard timepieces. There'll be 100 seconds to a minute, 100 minutes to the hour, 20 hours per day. But it was the 1st of April, 1975.
Oh, God.
So good.
Those meanies at the BBC. They said, it'll take 10 years for this to come through, so don't panic right now.
Yes.
Wow.
I mean, that's brilliant.
Do we know if people believed it?
It was a BBC broadcast, the Scene Around Six, so people would. God,
I thought the French government actually did something similar with the calendar, didn't they? Ooh, the French Revolutionary calendar had
they
10
wanted
months
to.
In it.
Yeah.
I think they might have even tried.
But they did an April 1st.
No, it wasn't the April 1st thing. It's just do this or you get your head chopped off thing.
Napoleon loved a joke.
What if the French Revolution was just an April Fool's that got badly out of hand?
Guys, hey, we were joking.
What if there was no king?
I didn't say no king. I said joking.
Oh, God. The people who do the speaking clock, just quickly on that. Back to my obsession, Brian Cobby, who I love. Bizarrely, 2 out of 5 of them have been from Hove.
Really?
I'm not suggesting any conspiracy or anything like that, but I just find that quite weird. They always have loads of finalists, by the way. The last time they did it, there were 15 finalists, which is so many for the judges to listen to. But when Brian Cobby got the job, the runner-up was a lady from Lowestoft, and she got the consolation prize. Can you guess what the consolation prize for this specific job would be?
Doing the London Underground announcement?
Not bad, very close.
That's good. Oh, doing like a Sainsbury's announcement, you know, sort of aisle 6. Needs
very
replenishing.
Very close. Okay, I'll tell you. She got this. You will all have heard this. The runner-up became the voice of, the number you have called has not been recognised.
No!
That
is...
Oh my God, and the most terrifying words you can ever hear as a child. Was she the person who did the... when he did 1471 as well?
Oh, I don't know.
Because I think
you were called today at 17:22. Yeah. Oh, I think you might. It is a similar voice. I think it might be. Her.
I think it might be because I always found the most terrifying thing was
really. I found it quite sexy.
What to have had?
Oh God, Dan.
Did you have this in Australia? When you did 1471, if someone called, you're alone in the house. You're 12, and usually it'd be you were called today by this number, and then 1 in 10 times it would go, you were called today at 1700 hours. The caller with their number.
Why would they do such a
terrifying?
Look in the cupboard on the third floor.
Yes. The ethical burglars will be fine.
I was just generally looking into interesting clocks, not just speaking clocks.
Okay.
Can I give you a couple of interesting normal clocks?
Are they sexy clocks to go with this new facet of your personality?
I'll let you be the judge. I'll let you be the judge. No, I was reading that Windsor Castle, so on the Queen's staff, is an actual clockman who goes around every single day checking out all of the clocks within the Windsor estate, which is up to 400. There's 250 clocks within the castle itself. If he looks at his, you know, pedometer, he gets 16,000 steps in every single day. Yeah, and the clocks there are absolutely amazing. So there's your normal clocks, but you've got historical clocks, right? So my favorite one is that there was a clock that was made by Charles Clay in 1740, and it plays melodies by the composer Handel. And 4 of the songs that it plays were composed specifically by Handel for this clock.
So
they're original pieces. They worked in collaboration, and I think they made a few of these that went out to different royal families all through Europe. And it, you know, it's just an extraordinary thing that has pipes underneath it and so on that plays out the tunes. And they have all sorts of clocks like this that have historical relevance within the castle itself.
Yeah. Can I tell you one more weird time? It's actually not a time thing. It's just a weird disembodied speaking voice thing, which is an innovation in Tokyo. It's a toilet that has just been launched in Tokyo where you don't need to touch anything. Because it's
like, how do you wipe your bum?
What? Okay, you might need to touch one thing.
Just stand and sort of fully the pumps come.
Because there are lots of studies that show that when people use public toilets, they kind of avoid using their hands. They'll step on the loo lever, which is actually a reason why you would need to step on the loo lever if the previous 50 people have all stepped on it. Because, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
So you walk in and you just say, "Hi, toilet." And it kind of responds. So if you, it gives you a menu of actions. You can flush the toilet.
Hello, or, you Andy. Know. Back again.
The sexy,
you sexy
toilet.
Thing.
I don't know what you could say. I don't know if you could say, get my knob out. I don't think you can do that. But it's...
Yes. Yeah, you... So how's it work? So
you say turn on the tap or flush the toilet. Yeah. So that's the hands-free element of the system.
Okay.
I think it may even be able to raise and lower the seat. I'm not sure.
But you've still got to sit on the seat, which is, I would argue, largely the biggest bit of touching that yeah. happens in the...
You can hover slightly above it.
Can you? I don't have the thigh muscles to achieve that, I'm afraid.
You lay the loo roll down on the seat.
I cover the whole thing.
But you can do both. You can lay it and hover.
Oh, wow.
So you're like doubly protected.
Double safe. Well, I mean, we have those anyway. We have toilets which is so irritating.
Voice activated ones.
No, but as in we have the non-touch version, which I hate, which is the ones where when you stand up, they flush off their own accord.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, sometimes you'll just stand up to turn around a bit, to wipe your bum, whatever, or to hang up your coat halfway through a wee, and then it flushes itself.
Mid-wee. I'm just going to hold this in, take my coat off,
it's good
hang
practice.
It up.
It's like, clench those muscles.
Where is this at home? Where are you hanging it? Are you going out the toilet to the,
it's to in the neighbor's hanger house, in the hall?
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is Anna.
My fact this week is that Spain's gold reserves can only be accessed via drawbridge.
It's very cool. And they have a dragon as well, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
The other end of the drawbridge,
and
yeah.
A trumpeter, like...
This is most of Spain's gold, which is in a Bank of Spain vault in Madrid. And it's very well protected, as a lot of gold reserves are. But it's such a cool setup. So to get to the gold reserves, you have to penetrate three massive steel doors. And they weigh, like, the first door weighs 16 tons, which is about 8 hippos worth.
Wow.
And also they fit so well. So when the door closes, it fits so tightly that according to the bank, even if like a tiny bit of fluff got in there, it would sense it and would not be able to close. It would say, you know, you've got to get rid of that fluff. Anyway, once you've got through these doors, then you go down a 35-meter elevator shaft underground, and you're let out. I think you walk through a tunnel, and then you've got to cross a drawbridge. So a drawbridge has to be let down over a moat. It's not a moat. It's just a ditch. And I think it's about 3 or 4 meters drop.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I struggled to find... There are, like, obviously, pictures are quite limited with this kind of thing. They're quite secretive about it. And once you've got through the retractable drawbridge, you've got the gold.
No, there's another door, isn't there?
Oh, then there is another door, one of the last doors. Yeah.
And there's two people standing outside telling you a riddle. And you need to...
But I love the way they... Because they have it's not just a ditch. They have a mechanism for filling that ditch with water.
Yeah.
So the entire vault is under, obviously under the city surface, but it's under... There's a subterranean canal which flows along beneath the city. And then the vault is beneath that. And so if they need to flood it at any point, they just divert a bit of the subterranean canal, which will then slosh down into the drawbridge area and then completely flood that so that there's no way of getting in or out.
Unless you're a fish.
A trained...
trained fish.
A goldfish.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Very nice.
Yeah. Got to watch out for them.
Is it possible that this is just all made up?
It's just in someone's... back garden, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just a tiny, like a hotel safe, you know, with just 4 punched numbers in. Have they just created a myth so that we think, whoa, it's like Area 51?
Those are impossible, the hotel safes I find to get into. I have a curious knack of, like, locking myself out before I've put any of my stuff in the safe. I have to call someone at reception, and it's whole thing.
What kind of do you put your stuff in the hotel safe, you paranoid android?
Yeah, of course I do.
Do you?
Passport, money belt. traveler's checks.
Fanny pack.
Actually, while you're talking about those locks, can I just, as a mathematician, raise a bugbear about terminology? So, you know these locks, bicycle locks, what do you call them?
I call it combination lock.
Yeah, combination.
Yeah, yeah.
So, if imagine the combination was 1984.
Okay.
Like the Orwell book.
My birth year. Yes, Orwell's book. Yeah.
But a dystopian year in many ways.
Yeah. But imagine you put 1948, would it unlock it?
Ooh, Terry Pratchett's birth year.
Oh my God.
Why would it not unlock it? I'm just like a maths lesson here. Why would it not
because it's in the wrong order.
Yeah, correct. Mathematically, 1984 and 1948 are the same combination because combination is just a set of numbers or letters in any order. The word, when they're in the precise order, in the precise numbers, it's a permutation. So actually, it should be called a bloody permutation lock. It's bugged me for years.
Wow. Well, I'm so glad you've had a chance to air it, and now we'll all call them permutation locks.
I mean, that is because James calls a single panini a pinino, and he is going to be absolutely thrilled to hear that it's a permutation lock. This is great.
I really want to set James up in some way, like expose him to a combination lock, get him to refer to it as a combination lock.
Okay, one of us next week picks a combination lock.
Facts, yes.
I don't see that.
Take him down right at the top. Sorry, Bobby.
That's
sorry.
So good. That's so good.
That's great.
This bank vault door, the armoured door in the Madrid vault, there's one extra thing about it, which is that it's constantly covered with a thin layer of Vaseline.
Oh, yeah.
Just in case you got a bit excited.
Just in case. Wait, is that a talking vault?
Sexy talking vault.
In case Dan turns up with his robbery tools in one hand.
Did you get the gold? Actually, I got a bit distracted.
But it stops it rusting because it's made of steel, but not stainless steel. And so it constantly has to be very slightly protected from rusting.
So someone's job is to apply Vaseline.
There must be like a basically a vault goblin who has a huge tub of Vaseline just left out there all the time.
Every day. Smoothest hands on earth.
Welcome.
Remove the fluff, then apply the Vaseline.
Yeah.
Vaseline. Fluff on the door. Very bad.
I couldn't find out why they're not stainless steel. It says everywhere they've got steel, but it's not stainless, so you need Vaseline. Did they just cock it up at first?
Maybe old. It's an old door, the stainless steel process. I mean, lots of bank vault doors are very elderly because, you know, you make them once.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know.
Is it all bullshit? With the drawbridges and the fucking ditches.
Yeah. Didn't know this before. Gold bars get ultrasound done on them, like pregnant women.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. They probe it and they measure the reflections from the bottom or from within it. And that's because in the early 2000s, there was a panic that gold bars might have been adulterated with tungsten. Because tungsten has a very similar density, really similar density.
Oh, really?
But sound travels at different speeds through tungsten or through gold. So if you had gold bars which had been adulterated,
you'd know.
Yeah.
So when you think of gold vaults, what obviously Bank of England, any other famous place you can think of?
Fort Knox.
That's the one, Fort Knox.
Yeah.
So I think, Goldfinger, 1964, is probably what gave it its prominence. People think it has up to half of the American gold reserves.
Wait, sorry, was that that was the Bond plot line for that movie?
Yes, Fort Knox.
Right.
Yeah. So obviously, conspiracy theorists again, like, oh, there's no Fort Knox. There's nothing inside there. There's just like Vaseline and fluff. So presidents were actually denied access to Fort Knox, apart from one president. Do you know which one? First half of the 20th century. Often known by three initials.
LBJ.
FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So in 1943, he's the only US president to have visited Fort Knox.
Really?
Because he was concerned that it wasn't secure enough to be protected from foreign invasion if the worst happened in World War II. So he is the only president that we know has visited it.
Are they allowed to keep presidents out? I thought the president could basically go wherever he likes.
They're not given access to it. But yeah, he's I think maybe if they like said back Obama or Trump, I want to see Fort Knox, probably, but he's the only one that we know.
That's amazing.
But what's even more fascinating is in World War II, they were worried about bombs falling in Washington, D.C. So actually they moved things like the originals of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the Declaration of Independence to Fort Knox. But even like Winston Churchill got on the act. So our Magna Carta was moved in 19... So for international Magna Carta is like the UK version of the Bill of Rights, 1215, they moved that to Fort Knox.
Did they? Because I know we moved our gold to Canada, which I hadn't realised, which seems like a huge undertaking in the Second World War. But we sent it to Canada, and so the Bank of England vault became a canteen in the Second World War.
I've been to the Bank of England canteen.
Have Have you? Cool. Hang on. So is that?
It's not still. The vault is. The vault has been turned back into a vault. It's
is
not
that
still
back into a vault now? So have you been to the vault the actual that
canteen.
Was a canteen?
I've just been to the actual canteen twice.
You've had a sandwich at your local branch of
very good
Lloyd's.
Like, why have you brought all this Vaseline? What's going on?
The Bank of England vault key is 3 feet long.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
That is
great, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's real old school. That's dragon and moat style stuff.
But is it mainly like? Is it like a javelin stick with one thing at the end, or is it all the way down?
It's not notched all the way along.
Yeah, it's not notched all the way along. That would be amazing.
Yeah, that would be really good.
That's really funny. Yeah.
I think it's pretty remarkable, by the way, that the Bank of England, which is in central London, Bank Station is right next to it if you get on the underground line. In fact, the actual tunnel itself has to take a bend. Next time you're on the underground, you'll notice that there's a turn, and that's because they're going around the vault. Ooh, it's because they're literally going around the vault. And inside this vault is 400,000 bars of gold. So that's worth over 200 billion just sitting something like a half hour's walk from where we are right now. $200 billion.
Waiting in half an hour, guys. I got some Vaseline.
It's amazing, yeah. And there are really strict rules about how much gold you can keep, how many layers of gold you can keep in the Bank of England vaults. And this is a big difference between London and New York. So London is mostly on clay, so you're not allowed on most levels to stack the gold higher than 4 or 6 pallets, because it will just start sinking into the ground, and that is a problem. So whereas New York is on granite, and you can store gold as high as you like in there, it will not collapse.
Yeah,
and I think north of the river in London, generally it's the surface is stronger. So if Bank of England was south of the river, it would sink even further.
Yeah, you're so right, because that's why we could build the underground. Yes, at a certain level.
Is that why there are no underground stops south of the river?
That's one of the reasons. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, ground's too soft. Yeah.
I just outside of gold, but still with vaults, was looking into sort of precious items that have been kept in the vaults of our world. And it's stuff that is kind of seen as the precious secrets of our world. So, for example, the formula for Coca-Cola, supposedly kept in a bank vault.
Equals MC Square.
Not equals MC Square, but because Einstein's eyeballs are in a safe deposit box in New York. Oh. Do you remember after he died, there was a surgeon who took his brain away and took his eyes and took... And so the eyeballs have still not...
I thought it was just his brain.
No, his eyeballs are sitting in a vault or a safe deposit, you know.
They must be preserved slightly. They can't just be loose in a box.
I think they're probably in formaldehyde, you know, sitting in a little beaker, I imagine.
I didn't know. Was that because they had to get the brain out the eye sockets, do you think? They had to remove the doors first.
I think once you're just collecting bits of him, you might as well grab him while you're there, right? It's, you know.
That's so creepy.
Yeah, it is creepy. Dr. Pepper, the formula for Dr. Pepper, that's sitting in a vault somewhere. The secret ingredients of how you make WD-40 are sitting in a vault. And they were moved once, which was on the product's 50th birthday. The guy who took it was the CEO, Gary Ridge, who rode on a horse through Times Square while wearing a suit of armor and holding the secret ingredients to WD-40.
Yeah. Before he reached the drawbridge, yeah.
Yes.
That's incredible. But it wouldn't have been possible to rob him actually on that occasion, because he'd been so thoroughly lubricated in the armor that robbers would just slide off.
Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we have said over the course of this podcast, we can be found on our Twitter accounts. I'm on @Schreiberland, Andy.
@AndrewHunterM.
Bobby.
@Bobby_Seagull.
And Anna.
You can email podcast@qi.com.
Yep, or you can go to our group account, which is @NoSuchThing, or our website, NoSuchThingAsAFish.com. Check out all of our previous episodes. They'll be up there. Also, links to the final dates of our Nerd Immunity tour. We're going to be doing them in September. Come and see us live. It's lots of fun. But if you can't, we'll be back here with another episode next week, and we'll see you then. Goodbye.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.